Now we are.
Thank you.
All right, Erev Tov. Good to see everybody.
I think the guy was on drugs.
Good to see everybody. So I want to begin by saying that we're in the middle of the chapter, in essence, and you know that we were discussing the child and whether the child was rebellious and stubborn. We did a Mishnah just recently, still concerning the topic, over as the parak continues, let him die while he's innocent. So it says, Ben Sorer More Nidon Al Shem Sofo. We judge this child now according to his end, and we got into quite a philosophical conversation. Is that really how we should assess whether or not we should judge a child? And talked about the value of life versus those we feel as societally minded people, that you have to have some systems that come to be preventative in terms of justice. All that said, the perek itself, which could really end if we were only talking about what was talked about at the beginning of the Mishnah perek of the chapter, which is Ben Sorer Moreh, now is going to take a turn. And it's going to base it on this concept of upon a person's end, he is in essence judged, or there is some sense of you can administer justice. And we're not going to talk about a son per se, though a relationship between a father and a son is going to come into focus according to the understanding of the Talmud when it comes to the case we're about to look at. But the case we're about to look at on page 72, A1, we're going to put aside for a second, and, sorry, Laura, the bottom one is my top sheet, thank you. So we're going to look for a second at the Torah about where the following case, the next case in our Mishnah and then the Gemara is going to be taken from, and we're going to look at it closely with this source sheet that I handed out. I hope everybody's now got one. There's some extras here. And this source sheet is copied from this version of the Mikraot Gedolot, the Rabbi's Bible. I don't know if we have it here in our library yet, we should say, but it's the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, Mikraot Gedolot. It was a project began many years ago. The first one that came out was the volume Exodus. I believe all five are done. I can't say it. I'm not positive. And what the editor did, I think along with some help from friends, is recreate more than Rashi translations of all the major mefarshim, all the major commentators into English that would appear on a traditional page of Mikraot Gedolot, what we call the quote-unquote the Rabbi's Bible, if you read Barry Holtz's Back to the Sources. And that is that Rashi is put on a page with Rashbam, Nachmanides, with Ramban, with Ibn Ezra, with other commentaries that are included. In this one particularly, you really have Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, and Nachmanides. You have two translations of the text itself, the old Jewish Publication Society translation and the new Jewish Publication Society translation. And then in additional comments, the editor and working group chose other comments that would help either clarify or many times offer an alternative opinion, as we know the commentators themselves had. And in this sense of having all these people around the page, when it comes to Torah text, we have a Talmudic discussion without the editorial process of that last layer of Talmudic project work, which was, according to some, the Sforaim, right, who edited the Talmud at the close of the Talmudic period and created that kind of way that a Talmud sugya flows with the parlance, the legal parlance, right? Uraminhu, to bring another source over and against the one that was already presented. Eni, really? Is that really how these kinds of layers of editorial work didn't happen with the commentators from Bible times. Didn't happen because no one felt like they needed to create, in terms of Bible commentaries, any type of collective project where multi-generational rabbis, who are the Rishonim, according to the way we speak about them, they didn't need to be put into dialogue per se in the way that the Gemara has it edited. The expectation sometimes was that you might have one or another commentary that you followed in your given area of the world, and you had it extant, an extant copy of it in Kitav Yad, in handwritten form, and you might not have had the rest. And the advent of the printing press to create the kind of multiplicity of commentaries within a volume of the Torah then becomes quite a project. And again, no one feels like there needs to be an editorial project per se of putting one parshan against another, though you will have sometimes different people collect the commentaries that they're interested in before either presenting their own opinion, or they try to make harmony between different parshanim. And that becomes a little bit of its own world of sometimes trying to understand what the different commentators are saying. That's maybe a project. Another project might be to continue looking at the grammar of the Bible in ways that we understand grammar in better terms. Another one might go a different direction and try just to understand Rashi. And there might be five commentators about Rashi collected in a book that looks just like this. So Rashi's here, and five super commentaries around Rashi are collected. And it looks kind of like the typical Mikro Gedolo, but it really is commentary on Rashi, who's commenting on the Torah, and then ultimately they get to some meaning. I wanted to bring us the Talmudic discussion that exists without the editorial nature of the Talmud per se on the pages of the Mikro Gedolot about our verses that will be the ones referenced in our Talmudic sugya. This sheet has two sides. The first side has the letter A and the big Chafbet, chapter 22. The second side has the B, C, D, E, and F noted. Okay, so chapter 22 of Exodus is what we're looking at. The verse begins, Im b'machateret yimatze haganav v'huka. Now over to the other side. Vamet ein lo damim. There's a new sheet for tonight. Yeah. Can we get one more
possible? Okay, thank you.
Yes, you have another.
It's small enough printing.
Thank you.
That it's worth having your own, I think.
Okay.
So that's verse 1 of chapter 22. Im zarcha haShemesh alav damim lo. Shalem yishalem im ein lo v'nimkar b'genevato. Im himatze timatze v'yado ha-geneva mishor ad chamor ad se chayim shnayim yishalem. Back to the first side, 22. If the thief is seized while tunneling and he is beaten to death, there is no blood guilt in his case. If the sun has risen on him, there is no blood guilt in that case. There is blood guilt in that case. If the sun has risen on him, there is blood guilt in that case. He must make restitution. If he lacks the means, he shall be sold for his theft. But if what he stole, whether ox or ass or sheep, is found alive in his possession, he shall pay double. Let's read the OJPS. See if it differs, because translations are interpretations in themselves. If the thief be found breaking in and be smitten so that he dieth. So the difference between found and seized might be somewhat of a question. Even more important. So tunneling in versus breaking in, we'll see a little bit of why one's translated that way and the other. There shall be no blood guiltness for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood guiltness for him. He shall make restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft be found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall pay double. So far, right. So what's the understanding we have? What's the case? What are the facts? What happened?
Captured men, or if he's tunneling, or he got in, he's breaking in, one way or another, and he has stolen something, right?
Okay.
And he's caught, and he's been killed by the householder, I guess.
Yeah, I would just say to you, at the beginning of the case, he didn't necessarily steal something. If it's found later, okay, could be.
But he said, "Bamustem yumatzeganav." That means they already call him a thief, so they identify him as a thief.
Oh, because this is one of the points. Even though the text doesn't say he actually took something, the text calls him a thief.
Because
we obviously see that his intention is to steal.
No, he wanted to bring flour.
The question, though, that we're getting by actually purporting, might it be that he's breaking in for some other reason? We're not really asking that question. But what are we asking by purporting any kind of question at all about his intentions? Is... might he have an intention to actually go through with a murder should the owner of the property stand to protect his own property? That's the question that's important to understand vis-a-vis the thinking of the rabbis and the Gemara. We imagine and assume and presume that he's a thief. The text called him that. It's not really a question to say, is he really coming to steal something? But the question is, would he go through with a murder? Should, in a natural state, we assume, the balabait, the master of the house, would stand up and protect his belongings? That's an essential question. Now, next piece. So it says that there is no blood guilt if what? If the thief is either seized or found breaking in and be smitten so that he dies or beaten to death, no blood guilt. Who holds no blood guilt?
The family of the thief.
Well, the person who killed him.
The homeowner has no blood guilt. Why?
Defense.
No blood on his hands. He has no blood on his hands. In other words, at that point, the one who is breaking in is chayav mita. Has a sentence of death.
If it's by machteret, right?
If it's by machteret and whatever that is. Right?
Here he hasn't actually stolen anything. We don't know that.
You don't know.
It's not relevant.
He didn't kill anyone.
But it may not be relevant if you answer that, in fact, we know that he would have followed through and murdered the person, murdered the homeowner. So it's the beginning of major self-defense here. So there's no blood guilt in this case. If the sun has risen on him, there is blood guilt in that case. Without, maybe you read it already and it won't be fair of me to ask, but if you didn't read it already, what is if the sun came up on him?
During the day.
In the day. Right. The first is at night, the first second is at
night. Oh, good.
It's underground, so, or the assumption is the tunnel is underground.
If it's still totally light at night, then he came out of the tunnel.
Let's just purport. So, A, it could be that it was underground and he comes up and it's daytime. And if it's daytime, what?
He's still alive. You can see him.
You can see him and? Not as much of a threat. You can assess the situation. You could even, what? Run?
Get help.
So, okay. Then there is blood guilt. Let's stop there for a second. Let's look at some of the commentaries now. Go back to the page where it said 22. Go down the left side, right kind of underneath the A, down to 22.1. While tunneling. See Rashi? While tunneling. Machteret. Literally breaking in. The old Jewish Publication Society to the house. So the literal meaning of the word machteret is breaking in. As opposed to the new translation of the Jewish Publication Society, which said, if a thief is seized. So sometimes going back to there gets to the truer roots of the word. There is no blood guilt in the case. Literally, he has no blood. It is not considered murder. The thief is essentially considered dead to begin with. Here, Torah teaches you, if someone is coming to kill you, kill him first. And this thief is coming to kill you. For it's obvious that no one will stand by silently while others take his property. Quoting a Gemara. An assumption in ours, and a passage in Yoma. It is a given, therefore, that the thief has determined to kill the property owner if he resists. Go over to Ibn Ezra to the right. 22.1, while tunneling. The word is machteret, which is derived from the verb hatar. In the dark, they break into houses. Job 24:16. He's bringing you a little bit more about the grammar always, about some meanings of words, straightforward meaning of things. From if the sun has risen of verse 2, we know that the break-in mentioned here must occur during the night. For during the day, people would see him, but at night there is no rescuer around, and a thief might kill the homeowner. So there is no blood guilt in the case. Literally, no blood. That is, there is no redeemer to avenge the spilling of his blood. The Hebrew word for blood is sometimes used in the singular and sometimes in the plural, as here, because the blood actually carries all four of the bodily humors. Black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, as medical experts will tell you. Well, medical experts of his day.
Maybe not even.
Right. But we do see that there's some type of social understanding at a certain level and relating to try to figure out what's really going on among human beings and in their physiology. Turn to the other side of the page now.
What's the writing?
13th century. Rashi is 11th century. Ibn Ezra is 13th century.
12th
century. Ibn Ezra's text is finally coined probably the beginning of the 1200s.
He died in the 12th century.
Right, he lived then, and then 13th century the text is kind of put together entirely. 12th century for Nachmanides. So again, I want to go back over here to Rashi, where it says, see, if the sun has risen on him. This is merely a kind of metaphor. If it is clear to you that his intentions toward you are peaceful, as the sun brings peace to the world, if it's obvious to you that he has no intention of killing, even if the property owner resists him, for example, if a father breaks in to steal his son's property, everyone knows that the father loves his son and has not come with murder in mind. This is where you realize that Rashi takes from Talmud in order to understand the simple sense of the Torah. So anybody who says that Rashi is simply pshat, which means the simple sense, which is a movement of reading during the Middle Ages especially, to try to get to the most straightforward meaning of the text, right? That's what we kind of hear from those who say that Rashi is pshat. Well, Rashi's pshat is the Talmud in this case. And we'll see it inside. And whether or not that's truly the only possible case that the Torah is describing, I leave for us as an open question. But his piece here is to offer that, in fact, it was this case where the father broke in. Bahashemesh. The sun shines on him. Oh, that can't be. My father would never kill me. Therefore, what? If he kills him, what?
Yeah.
Guilty. There is blood guilt in that case. He has blood. The thief is considered a live person, and if the homeowner kills him, it's considered murder. He must make restitution. The thief must restore the amount that he stole, but he's not subject to death. So it kind of makes a shift in the verse of the Torah back to the question of, do I have to pay back for what I stole? The restitution question goes back to the thief at that point in the Torah. Onkelos, however, translates if the sun has risen on him as if the eye of the witnesses has fallen upon him. So he interprets it differently to say that if witnesses find the thief before the homeowner shows up, and when the homeowner shows up, they warn him not to kill the thief, then there is blood guilt in that case. So Onkelos, the early Aramaic translation of Torah, sees yet another possibility, that you actually had witnesses. How do we know that Onkelos then had some conception of the Talmudic way of jurisprudence? Because two witnesses warning anyone about killing someone is part of what's going to, again, be later in our Gemara in terms of what has to happen if you're going to kill someone in self-defense. You have to have people who warn you. Remember, this is the way the law works. If this guy's intention is to really kill you, then you can kill. But if this guy's intention is really not, we have to warn you against the killing. He's liable if he kills him. For when there are witnesses, the thief is not going to kill the homeowner. He shall be sold for his theft, for his theft teaches that women cannot be sold for theft. Again, taking women out of the picture, just like we had the action of taking women out of the picture when it was Ben and Lobot, when it was son and not daughter at the beginning of our chapter of the Gemara, vis-a-vis who could be ruled a stubborn and rebellious child. This is a move the Gemara often likes to make in different cases, excluding one gender versus another, especially when it can be for the benefit of the said gender.
So when we say Akamlo v'chakum v'ashkem le'afko means only at night?
According to what we've read so far, the case is at night, except Bahashemesh might not be.
So if I want to start a war to avoid a destruction of my city during daytime, it's no good to protect my fellow citizens. It's written in the Bible, Akam lo v'chakum v'ashkem le'afko. What you said is, if a machteret, if it's dark, you can kill him because you don't know his intention.
We would not learn from laws of individual thieves and homeowners to the wars that you can either proclaim to be in self-defense or that are obligatory or that are reshut, permissible. So in and of itself, there's like what the Gemara says, a maishani. What's the distinction here and over there? So that's the short answer. This is not our topic, and that's not our topic, and thusly, we learn out what we need to for our case.
So this whole conversation is on a personal level?
This is about the thief who comes in. Remember, we're being very specific, and we're not trying to extrapolate either. When the Gemara wants to extrapolate to further cases, we might see that they're making reference to such things.
Somebody who breaks in at night probably expects to encounter the home. That's when people are at home.
Mm-hmm.
If he avoids doing that, risks being seen, but does it in daytime, the assumption may be that nobody will be at home because they are at work, school, doing whatever they do during the day. Meaning, I do not want to put myself in a situation of a thief.
Right. So we're talking about what would indicate intention and not, and there is a mode of thought that goes that direction.
Well,
how do we really tell?
In our jurisprudence, in fact, the penalty for a nighttime burglary is more severe than a daytime. So breaking and entering.
Right. Case in. Yeah. I mean, those kinds of realities are definitely reflected here potentially. There are other reasons too, and they deal with the fact that Onklos. You know, in essence, the guilt of both the thief and the guilt of the homeowner, though by us, are called into question. The more extraordinary type of holding people accountable in terms of the acts of self-defense that they do here, and I suppose in our jurisprudence we would do the same, too. We would go after investigating whether or not it was truly a case of self-defense. But for sure, Torah is the place, is the core of that, and when it comes to this case, particularly in Masechet Sanhedrin. Because we want to know, was he warned? Onklos looking at that piece of the pie of whether or not the system is at work. Look at Ibn Ezra, where it says, if the sun has risen on him, if the homeowner kills the thief during the day, he may rightly be asked, there are people passing by everywhere. Why did you not let them know that this fellow was breaking in? You know, those who said he could go get help. There are lots of different ways. He must make restitution. This refers to the thief of verse 37 under the assumption that he has not been killed but caught. With regard to the distant reference, you might, so in other words, he wants to make sure that we know who we're talking about here, who has to pay restitution, and then go down to F, Nachmanides, if the sun has risen on it. See Rashi's comment as well as his remarks about Onklos. I find them surprising. This is kind of that Talmudic notion here that the commentators have. He's in conversation with Rashi and Onklos at this point. When verse 1 says there's no blood guilt in that case, it must refer to a situation where the homeowner was warned not to kill the thief, since it is a principle of Jewish law that the murderer never incurs the death penalty unless he has been warned not to commit the killing. So what's the problem he's pointing out with the thief? He doesn't get the death penalty unless what? He was warned not to kill. But what did we say about our understanding of his mens rea, of his intentionality? That he was prepared to kill. So Nachmanides goes back to that notion here of also using a part of what he knows is part of the legal situation and the legal rules. If you suggest that the phrase merely means that from the divine perspective it's permissible to kill the thief in that situation, that is simply not true. Rather, verse 1 acquits him from both the legal and the divine perspectives, and verse 2 makes him liable from both perspectives. So what does that mean, divine versus legal? You have a mitah, a death sentence of the Beit Din sometimes, versus you have the death sentence of heaven. In various cases, either land or result in one or the other. Perhaps what Rashi means is that if the thief sees that he is observed, he is no longer considered a threat to life, whereas in the dark, the thief is likely to kill the homeowner and flee. Back to the point we just heard. Daytime, A, he might not be expecting the homeowner, and B, he might think that the homeowner is going to see him, and thusly, what? Really not have the intention to kill. Or at least the homeowner couldn't think so. In my opinion, what Unklos meant was once the thief came out of the tunnel and was seen. So that the phrase, im baha shemesh, the sun rose on him, really means once he's out of that tunnel. There's blood guilt in that case. Just as for any other person, it's forbidden to kill him, and if he does kill him, he's put to death. But the thief must certainly pay if he took something. The text is speaking about what's usual. Thieves ordinarily come at night when no one can recognize them, and in that situation, there is no punishment for killing them. But if the thief lingers until daylight, sneaks away, and flees for his life, he can be identified by witnesses and is no longer subject to death, either by the court or by the homeowner. So the actual sentence of death that's being questioned vis-a-vis the thief coming in is whether or not, in fact, it's true that the sentence of death exists on the thief and that it's legal for the homeowner to actually take his life, in Nachmanides' understanding. The daytime becomes absolute concrete daytime for Nachmanides, and he relates to the question of whether or not it just means that he's come out of the tunnel at all at any point, based on the understanding of other people. So you, based on the understanding of Unklos in this case. So, again, the dialogue on the page is a little bit of what interests me as well, because I want to just note that it wasn't edited into a conversation, but it could have been, if that was the textuality of the Jewish people that existed, and only that way could we relate to a multiplicity of rabbinic opinion about any given case or scenario. Mefarshim, commentators of the Torah, exist on a page in their spots, sometimes in dialogue with one another, sometimes not at all, and they oftentimes need to be brought into that vein. And I've mentioned before from the Bima on Shabbat that who's a classic example of that all the time, trying to bring people in conversation with each other? Nechama Leibowitz, who takes from various commentators these on the traditional page of Mikra Gedola, those in other time periods, and she is trying to really have them speak to each other. And today her students are continuing to collect different voices and different Torah commentaries from throughout the Achronim, not just the Rishonim, this period of Rishonim, the Achronim, the later commentators, and modern commentators, to have them be in dialogue with one another. At some point, there's enough dialogue going on where people are writing more rational Torah commentary, comparing one or another or five different perspectives on Torah, and those kinds of books are being written, in essence, in our own generation. They didn't exist before. Leket, HaTorah, various collections of articles. Hagaot B'Parashat HaShavua, looking into the weekly Parsha. These kinds of books get back to a more Talmudic project. Thought it an interesting place to start, vis-a-vis looking very simply at the verse, because the Mishnah really wants us to be in dialogue with these verses of Torah and understand them very deeply so that we can understand the ongoing and ensuing conversations that the sages will have. Restated in the Mishnah now. Page 72A1. Hababa machteret nidon al shem sofo, to use the language of what we had before, that the son is judged on his end. Now, also, the burglar who enters a house by tunneling through its wall is judged on his ultimate end. That is, although he's not done any capital crime yet, we assume what? His course of action leads to murder. And thusly, he can be seen as someone who's deserving of death. Now, Haya Baba Machteret Vishavaret HaChavit. Now we get into a little bit more of a case, though. So, if a burglar was entering a house, and he's tunneling through, and here it says tunneling through a wall, you know, again, the question, was it tunneling through a wall? Was it making an underground tunnel where you absolutely have no light? You know, these are the kind of things that come up with reading the text and seeing it plainly. You know, if you ask somebody to just read that Torah text and say, go dramatize this. A lot of times people dig underneath the earth. They think that tunneling means burrowing.
Right, well, machteret.
and the use of the Hebrew word. This says through a wall here in our translation to say that there are other ways of looking at it. And he broke a barrel during the break-in. Shavar et ha-chavit. Now, what does that represent? What does the chavit represent? Breaking a barrel represents monetary damage to movable property. He breaks it. And the verb is shavar. He actually broke the monetary property. Im yesh lo damim. If his, the burglar's, blood is accountable, meaning it's forbidden to kill him, right? Chayav, he's liable for damage. Okay? So it says, down in the footnote below, which is very explanatory, although it's ordinarily permitted to kill a burglar who's tunneling into a house, there's an exception to the rule. If the burglar so clearly loves the occupant of the house that he could not possibly have intentions of murdering him, the burglar may not be killed. The classic example of this is a father who burglarizes his son's house. It can be taken for granted that even if caught, he would not kill his own son. Therefore, what? He may not be killed during the burglary. Our Mishnah teaches that in such a case, where the burglar may not be killed, he must pay for any damages he causes. Who said it? Rashi.
If it's happening in the dark, how is the son supposed to know it's his father has come into his house?
Can't you just feel the presence of a parent?
I have another problem. I'm just trying to.
So the question. I'm pointing out the following. I'm not even straw. What I'm showing through our reading and rereading of sources, footnotes, inside the Mikra Gedolot over here in our Gemara, I'm really asking the question, do the texts themselves ever explain to us, peshat, simple sense, that this is the case? If, and here's really the kind of inquiry question, if the text is so convincing that this is the only case it can be, that to me is an interesting question. Obviously, the received tradition by Rashi being the explanation we go with often, vis-a-vis Torah and vis-a-vis Gemara, if that is the received tradition and Torah Sheba'al Peh was only written down in this way, tersely in the Mishnah, continued to be terse in the Gemara, and then only was really understandable by Rashi's bringing it to light in the middle of his Beit Midrash, and then it was captured, then we had to wait until, what was the year? What was the year of 10, I forget, 36, it was in Troy, that Rashi ultimately gave that over and explained it so well that it was written down in his commentary, and now we understand it, and that's what originally they meant back then. If it doesn't really bear out that way, I'm also interested in that question, because I'm interested in the intellectual pursuit of what could the case be otherwise? Is there a possibility that this is not that case? We get more facts in the Mishnah than in the Torah. This is one of my points now. The facts that we have in the Mishnah are as follows. I have Habab Machteret. Oh, by hearing that, I'm immediately brought to the verses in the Torah that I studied, that I want to know, that I need to know in order to relate to this Mishnah. And I have a further detail. Habab Machteret, Hayabab Machteret, Veshavaret Achavi. And he broke the barrel. So obviously it's someone who broke a barrel. Now I'm given that. And the Mishnah says, Im yesh lo damim chayav. And if the blood is accountable, then he's obligated. If I have to be now accountable for murdering, because he didn't have a deen, he didn't have a judgment on him as being Chayav Mitah. He doesn't have a death penalty on him. Then that person is Chayav to make restitution. So with the now facts, I'm really begging the question. But we saw in the footnote that they accept Rashi hands down.
I have a problem similar to it. First of all, about the question, how he knows that the father father. If they are so specific and they say Yimatzei Aganav, why didn't he say Yimatzei Arotzeach? If they want to, if killing is part of the deal, and if they don't say it, they are very specific about the Ganav.
Yeah. So Ron's question for Hebrew is as following. Ron's asking a question. If they're being specific vis-a-vis the intentionality of people, and they call the person in the Torah a thief by using the word ganav, why didn't they restate it in the Mishnah? I don't know if you said that, but I'll say it. Even if it didn't say it in the Torah, why don't we restate in the Mishnah that this person was coming as a murderer? Or even go further and call him a rodef, chasing after somebody to murder them. Because we don't have the adjudication yet in the Gemara, and we're not all the way there convinced that intentionality is totally understood. That's my answer. We're fleshing out whether or not the intentionality of certain criminal acts do in fact include the intentionality to murder. And we're asking these questions, just like when I buy a nice tartemar of basar, a measure of meat, and a half log yayin italki, and a half of a log of Italian wine, is my intention really to continue my drinking problem, continue to steal money, and ultimately kill for this, or kill in the state of being so addicted? You know, we're talking about questions of human motivation, human intentionality. So we're exploring. The case itself did offer other details that allow for Rashi and allow for the text to kind of explore this deeper. Let's read the let's really focus in for a second on the other part of the Mishnah, which we didn't get to, which is the end of it there. Im ein lo damim, and now it's going to give you the equal and opposite. If the blood is not accountable, i.e., he may be killed because he has indeed broken in, we do judge that he deserves the death penalty, patar, he's exempt from monetary liability. Let's go over that one again. Im ein lo damim, if we say that he's broken in and that he's actually chayav mita, he actually is now judged to have a death penalty, the death penalty on his head, the thief. And I could, as homeowner, kill him and therefore not pay on any account of the blood I spilled. I have no blood on my hands, as you said over here. The thief is patur. He doesn't have to make any monetary retribution.
This chayav mita doesn't mean that after the fact of the burglary, the homeowner can seek him out and kill him.
Oh, so here's the situation. If he had the sentence of death at the time that he was breaking into the house, let's ask it like a question, do we say that that death sentence ultimately exists 5 days from now and I could get my posse together and go kill him? I have the question, though, still, that he took some things from my house, and is he chayav to pay for them with penalty, no penalty, give me them back? Not give me exactly the things back, just give me money. Guess what, though?
He's not up.
He's patur. He's exempt, according to the Mishnah. He was obligated. He paid with his life. Though he didn't really pay with his life. Now, if he did really pay with his life, let's go back the other direction. If he did pay with his life, and I killed him and I'm the homeowner, what's the Mishnah teaching me? He's patur. Nobody has. He himself has nothing to pay back, nor any relatives. The estate doesn't owe me anything. But he broke my barrel.
Oh, we're still with the breaking the barrel.
So here's the situation. I use barrel, I use cheese wheels, all kinds of ancient things around the house. This guy comes and he breaks it. If I have no blood on my hands from actually killing him in self-defense, makes sense. I'm not going to do anything more. I'm not going to demand anything more, even if he broke 50 barrels of Italian wine. I'm a merchant. I have them stacked. He went into my warehouse. I lost all my money. He's pater. He's exempt. Nobody has the right to take that, you know, say it was a group. I realize it was a group trying to steal my wine. This individual is not represented by that group. I can't go back and ask them according to the way I interpret the Mishnah with the word pater. I'm not reading any parashim. I'm just doing a little work trying to figure out.
Do we distinguish between a home and a business and a warehouse?
So did it say Baida at all? Did it say house?
Yeah, it says a house.
Where? A Baba
Basilis.
In English.
If a burglar was entering a house by tunneling through a wall. But he broke up out.
It doesn't say two.
Right, exactly. So this is what I want to point out again. One says it's tunneling in. One says it's breaking in. One says it's kind of obvious. It sounds like a house at night where someone's sleeping. Another one says through a wall. In order to understand the pashat of the Mishnah, the simple sense of the Mishnah, I can start thinking in lots of different directions here.
Seems to me that there's you know, an issue of intent. Okay, and the fact is that all of the commentaries and things like that, okay, are determining on the basis of circumstantial evidence. It was happened in the daytime, it happened at nighttime, okay, it was one time. And that sounds like it doesn't go in line with clear-cut thinking, okay, in capital cases, that somebody had to know, you know, that if he did the crime, he was going to be killed, okay, and to witnesses, all the certainty that went around a death penalty, okay? A lot of that seems to be missing from all this circumstantial evidence that's going to determine whether somebody had the intent or not.
Nachmanides, and you're sitting in the same kind of place. Nachmanides says, wait a minute, aren't there systems that come to bear here? Onkelos said the same thing 1,000 years before Ramban. The question of whether or not the case actually represents one that we feel needs to procedurally be followed in order to have a sentence of death assumed on this person absolutely was not taken care of. And that's what may come to light with Ein Ba'al Shemesh as well, if the sun comes up. In other words, we realize this.
We have disincentivized the homeowner, the business owner, from killing the thief. I mean, he's able to, but it would prevent a revenge killing for, oh, you know, you're busting up all my stuff, I need to kill you now, and I'm okay doing it. Yeah, you're okay doing it, maybe, but you're not going to get reimbursed for them. So you want to... It makes you think much more carefully about whether or not you're going to kill this thief, whether you're truly in danger. Because if you let him live, you stand the chance of being compensated for the damages.
No doubt about it. So let me ask you, are you suggesting that the addition of the Shavarit HaChavit to the Mishnaic case is asking people to consider more carefully whether I invoke the law of self-defense or not?
I guess, well, what makes, in fact, a tourist, that word is sort of what made me realize. But I mean, yeah, the situation that you're talking about, yes.
So it just could be that they're mixing monetary compensation and the resultant laws with this case of self-defense and deciding about death penalties and whether or not I'm ready to kill. And what's the further evidence to that? First of all, is everybody there with me now and with Jay's question?
I have the opposite impression, because by not killing him, you have some possibility of getting compensated, and that's a greater incentive not to kill him. But if you know that you're not going to get compensated, then your only option is to kill him or let him go.
How do you know you won't be compensated?
Because if he's done something that earns the death penalty, but you don't kill him, then that's it. He's not liable for anything more. He's off the hook. So I,
no, I don't view that way.
I want to stay on this.
I understand earning the death penalty, meaning you're free to kill him. In other words, if you feel endangered and you kill him, that's what it means. It doesn't mean that if he then walks away, that he's subject to the death penalty.
Good. Yes, if he walks away, then you don't get any compensation.
Because he was subject
to
the
death penalty.
What you're saying would make this story in line with everything else we read, which is the punishment is death, but don't expect to actually, even though I forget who it is, says he went and sat on the grave of somebody.
Right. Right. So good. Let's. You have more to add to this specific understanding.
I would translate the damim like May Hanukkah in the case of Hanukkah. Damim means money and not blood deals. If somebody came and broke the barrel, if he has money in his hand, he can pay and then he's free to go. And if he's not, if he doesn't, in endlo damim, in endlo cases, then I'm allowed to kill him and I'm patur. That's the way I would translate it, because kamim has the meaning of money here and not blood guilt.
You know, damim definitely, I've seen the term mean money, I've played with the translation of damim as money for this Mishnah. I've not seen a commentary that plays with the translation money, but it's not far-fetched to sit in a Beit Midrash and make connections. I want to go over here and say that I think there is, though, the push and pull of whether or not you're going to actually take this kind of step in your sense of immediate, either, and I'm not painting any picture here, willingness to protect your household, willingness to protect your durable goods, passion in the heat of being faced with an intruder, and thinking about some type of whether or not you just need to give this up because a guy needs a cheese wheel and he's hungry, or it's some type of major thievery going on, major theft. All this comes into to kind of a balancing act in this Mishnah. I do agree on a philosophical level, and I believe the Bible is pointing us in that direction, by the way, and that critical Bible study in this case is the key to evidencing that in a very interesting way. Just hang with me for a minute. Go back to the page that I gave you. Critical Bible study shows that verse 37 of the previous chapter is all about durable goods, or in this case, livestock, monetary and livestock laws. So verse 37 says, when a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Forget for a minute that 1 is 5 and 1 is 4. There are questions about it. Then comes in our verses. A thief comes in tunneling. Comes the sun. And then verse 3, but if what he stole, whether ox or ass or sheep, is found alive in his possession, he shall pay double. Verse 4, when a man lets his livestock loose to graze in another's land, and so on. So really what the Bible has done is it's framed the Baba Machteret between two sections about the loss of animals and the compensation, the recompense that has to come after such kind of thievery. The fact that you had it within those two creates what's called chiastic structure of A, B, B, A. It goes back to the issue that you started with at the end of the last chapter. And even traditional commentators have noticed, and not just critical Bible study kinds of scholars, that it's couched here because you had to kind of figure out just how much you're willing to put your life on the line, and how much are we willing to put the lives on the line of people who are thieves of these kinds of goods. If someone, and we'll see in the Gemara later, comes to actually kill you and is called out as a rotseach or a rodef, that word is used Rotzeach means murderer. Rodef means chasing after someone to kill them. That kind of verbiage is used. Here, you had the word ganav, thief, used. The whole question is about intentionality again. The whole question is about now my responsibility as a homeowner and whether or not Baha Shemesh, the sun rising on anyone, means really, may this light be shed upon you. This understanding you need to bring with you to this case, no one said that explicitly in the commentaries, but it seems to be that, you know, the sun rising here could be metaphorical, as Rashi suggested, in this kind of shikul hada'at, the weighing of results, consequences, the death penalty or not the death penalty, etc. Let's push in to the Gemara. Gemara analyzes the Mishnah's ruling. We're on 72A1, left-hand column down at the bottom. Amar Rava. Rava says, "My Tama demachteret." What's the Mishnah's reason for ruling that someone caught tunneling into the house may be killed? Why does he deserve to die? Gemara explains, "Chazaka ein adam ma'amid atzmo al ma'amono." So there is, it says in this translation, there's a presumption. Not the word I learned for translating chazaka or chazaka. I learned the term a standing rule. We have a standing rule that a person does not hold himself back from defending his property. V'hai neymar amar, and knowing this, the burglar surely tells himself in advance, v'hai v'zeh, this one obviously tells himself, I azilna, if I go break into the house, ka'ela pa'im v'lo shavikli, the occupant will confront me and not allow me to rob him, v'ika'ela pa'im, and if he confronts me, katlen ale, I will just have to kill him. V'atora amra im ba lehorgecha or lehorgach hashkem lehorgo, and the Torah therefore tells the occupant of the house, if someone comes to kill you, anticipate him, anticipate it, and kill him first.
But he just came to steal.
Since we assume we have a chazaka standing rule that he's not going to stop defending his property, and that this guy will do everything in his power to kill me, I therefore say that he comes into the category of one who would pursue me to kill me, and I can kill him first. Oh, so back to where Rashi really explained that. Rashi explained that both in our comment in the Chumash, in the Torah, and Rashi explains it over here. We read the note. But it's really true that vis-a-vis Rashi, I'm in the first small line of the Rashi down the right-hand column. The yesh lo damim chayav im ein ra'ui lehareg kagon av al haben. If he's not really worthy to actually be killed and he has no sentence of death upon him, like a father in regards to a son, the Tanya the comment ein ha ben rashai laharog et aviv haba alav b'machteret mishum derach me'av ala ben, because the father's mercy really sits upon the child, and the father would never kill the son. V'lo ba'al iske nafeshot, and that in essence we don't say that he's going to really take his life, right? And his son doesn't stand against his father. In essence, that is what allows us to say that the case is what it is. That the case is I can't kill that person. And that is where, again, we have learned the detail that that's the case. The Gemara beginning with the presumed rule, or the standing rule, that I kill someone who's coming to kill me, is simply presented like this. The HaTorah Amra Im Ba Lahargach Hashkem Lahargo. There's not a footnote in the art scroll. There's not a shene'emar, as it's stated. There's not a ra'aya ledavar, a zecher ledavar, a proof for the thing or a remembrance for the thing. Simply stated. It's not. That's my point. Meaning, we're reading this very carefully, but we're reading it very definitively at this point. The Gemara cites a related ruling about a burglar. Amar Rav. Rav says, Hababa machteret v'natal kelim v'yatza. If someone enters a house by tunneling through its wall, or tunneling in, burrowing, whatever you want to say it is, and he takes some vessels and he leaves, patur. He's exempt from returning the stolen goods, even if they are extant. He's exempt. My Tama, what's the reason? For what reason is he exempt from returning the goods? We're going to now explain the Mishnah in a different language.
Sir, why do you use the word extant?
Even if they're still in existence.
Oh.
Bidamim kananhu. I'm on 72A2. 72A2. About 15, 16 lines down in the Gemara if you're looking at the block. Where in the Gemara? Fifth wide line. Bidamim kananhu. Fifth wide line, Ayin Bet Aleph. Go down to the wide lines.
Oh, wide lines.
Fifth wide line.
Right.
Ending word, bedamim, kananhu. Beginning of the sixth line. So, it is because he's acquired them with his blood. He acquired the vessels. He's patur. Why? Because he already paid by the fact that he's sentenced to death. That is, since he was subject to being killed during the burglary, he's exempt from any monetary obligation now. So, look at, down at line 9. It's an interesting rule. Rav's extending the teaching of our Mishnah. Our Mishnah teaches that when an intruder breaks a vessel during a burglary, he need not pay for the damage based on the principle that states what? He is subject only to the more severe punishment than the lighter one. Only subject to the more severe punishment than the lighter one. Kamla midraba mine. The higher punishment stands, the lower one doesn't.
I have a question. Just a quick question.
Let me just show you where that's stated again in the art scroll, so people, if you really were interested in the premise, back to 72A1 on the bottom, footnote 6. In a case where the intruder may be killed because he is considered dangerous, he's not liable for any damage he inflicts. This exception is based on the principle of kamle bidraba mine. He's subject only to the more severe punishment than it.
If absent the concept of thievery, if I decide that I want to kill someone, a particular person who's injured, have I acquired the death penalty as a result of that thought?
Are you tunneling into a house?
No. No, it's just somebody. I want to kill them. But I mean, seriously, I'm thinking, I really want to kill them. I'm just surprised here that notion that this person has resolved I may have to kill someone would bring upon him the death penalty.
It's not just that. It's the situation of Hababa Machteret.
Right. Well, but there's still, in other words, this person, what they're saying is if you're doing this, it means that you're prepared to kill the homeowner. Maybe it's a dumb thief who's not really prepared to kill the homeowner. I'm just saying...
It's more than that.
He hasn't
the homeowner
yet,
can kill him.
No, I'm not talking about that. He's not yet killed someone, is my question. But it seems as if this is saying he has assumed liability for having killed someone. Therefore, even if you don't kill someone, you've broken into their home, you don't kill them, you're walking away with the diamonds, guess what? You can keep them now because...
You took the risk.
The
risk is the price.
So what I'm saying is, it wasn't my understanding that one becomes liable for the death penalty for having been prepared mentally to kill someone absent doing it. So
this is the reality of this case, and when the case situation is presented and we are asking the question, first of all, we're understanding that the Mishnah assumes that in such a case it's true that we do ascribe to him the intentionality to kill. We're not saying, though, again, kind of like Maishani, we're not saying that anyone who just has a thought, X, Y, or Z, I'm going to kill this person, we're not saying that that's at all a we don't have jurisdiction over that, vis-a-vis this case law.
I'm just having trouble understanding that you can get away with thievery because it's the lesser, you're only liable to the more severe punishment when no one has any intention of actually carrying out that punishment yet.
Right, so that is a good question, and let's see if that gets at all resolved and or clarified by reading and rereading.
I've never asked a question this early in this new case.
No, but it's true that question can stand. In other words, how is it that we say he is patur? If we're just saying it because of the principle I just reminded, and they reminded us of in the footnotes, that's one thing. But if there's some other reason too, let's see. Let's see if we're included. The Gemara cites the following dissenting opinion to Rav's. Ama Rava, Mistabra Milte, the Rav Sheshiber. Rav's ruling is indeed logical in the case where the burglar broke the vessel. That what? He broke the vessel and then what? He's putter. He's exempt. Delete Nahu, so that it no longer exists. In such a case, the burglar is indeed exempt from compensating the owner for the value of the vessel. Aval natal lo. But if he took some kind of vessel and it still exists in the world, then Rav's ruling is not logical. This guy, he went home, he's got the barrel, he's got the cheese wheel, he's got the item from my house. In such a case, the burglar surely has to return the stolen vessel. Rav notes that Rav himself rejects this distinction and explains why. Rav notes it. V'ha Elohim, and by God, Amar Rav afilu natal. And Rav is really holding this position even when the guy actually took something that could be returned. It's nice. V'ha Elohim. It's kind of like their expression for it. By God. Don't take the name of God in vain. He's really asking. It's not in here as a throwaway OMG. It's not. I just want to hang there for a minute and describe how serious the editors of the Gemara were to include that. Here we have the inclusion of the name of God. We're not praying. We're not teaching something about a prayer. We're using it as a rhetorical device. He's asking, can we really understand Torah's intention, God's intention, to mean that if he took something physically, he doesn't have to give it back? He's patur? A little different than just using it as an exclamation mark.
Sacrifice value and to make it into money to bring to Jerusalem. So we have precedent for the transformation of object into monetary value. Mm-hmm. So why does it matter whether you can return the object or you can't?
Right. Someone could ask that further question. Exactly, Laura. Not only is Natal and it's and exists over in his property, but by the way, maybe I should say that he's still obligated to pay the value of it, because we have all these cases where values are still obligations of people who took them. Daha yesh lo damim v'nen sufer, in a case where the burglar's blood is accountable, where it is forbidden to kill him, and the stolen goods were lost through an unavoidable accident, chayav. So Rava explains the logic behind Rav's ruling. Listen to the logic. It's going to take a couple steps. The Hayesh lo damim venensu. For in a case where the burglar's blood is accountable, where it is forbidden to kill him, that he would be accountable for it. And the stolen goods were lost through an unavoidable accident. Chayav, the burglar, is obligated. Alma birashute kaime. Evidently, then, the stolen goods are considered in the burglar's possession. They become the property of the burglar, and therefore he must absorb the loss. So he has no, what? He has no sentence of death upon him, right? He had the objects. What happened to the objects here, in this case? Lost through unavoidable accident. Then he becomes obligated. Ha chanami birushute kaime. Here too, where it is permitted to kill the burglar, the stolen goods are in the burglar's possession. That is, what? They become his property. This means that if the burglar returns the stolen goods, he is compensating his victim and not returning the victim's own property. Accordingly, the goods need not be returned, for a burglar whom it was permitted to kill is exempt from paying compensation. It's all a matter of transfer of ownership. Because, again, making the question, it's a difficult question. You're telling me that since I was, by all standards of the law, obligated a death penalty, and, by the way, no one killed me, and then I took this stuff, it transferred over to me, except for when, what?
He's getting lost on the way out.
He dropped it.
Or it broke. That's Rava's understanding of Rav. We're bringing lots of great legal questions to the scenarios, and what they're saying is, in this particular case, I think this is how he's interpreting without having that kind of problem. If we really want to say sometimes, oh, but where can I bring an issue? Should it say like this? Should we apply that area of law? There are a couple of ways to look at that in Gemara parlance. A, we could sit here and say, if the rabbis wanted to really challenge that notion, we would have had an argument from a sage, either a Tana, who brought it in a Braita, or an Amara. Sometimes, it's true, the Tosafot want to work that through. Right? Post-Rashi, next generation of commentators, want to see those legal principles worked out, harmonized. So we have every right to sometimes ask that as a commentary to the issue. But there seems to be an underlying assumption here that I'm not really worried about contract law here. I'm not really worried.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So in this version that I'm looking at,
yeah,
I seem to be troubled by two principles, like forcing the rulings into being consistent with these principles. Maybe you haven't thought about this, I don't know. One is that there aren't two punishments for one act.
Correct.
And the other is, there's no monetary punishment for something for which there's death is a punishment.
Right. So you have A, the principle of what we said, kamle midurabale. In other words, midurabamine. So you have only the more severe over the lesser, and in this case, monetary versus death penalty, death penalty is going to win it. Two, right, you don't have dine mamonot for dine nefashot. You don't have monetary compensations for death. You can have monetary compensation for corporal punishment, by the way. Somebody loses a limb, somebody gets really ill based on somebody else's actions, somebody hits somebody, and then there has to be money paid. Not only time lost, right, but over in Bava Kamma, I even kind of weigh the amount the person would amount to on the slave market. They did labor such as this, and I give money back. But that's not killing them.
So I hear it saying no two punishments for one act.
Correct.
And no,
you only have one, the more severe.
Always the more severe.
Correct.
So, So those principles seem to be more important than achieving an answer to some of the questions on the facts that are set forth here, which some of them sound pretty illogical.
Right. So,
is there something about these principles that is in the background that whatever happens, we can't undo these principles? Do they apply someplace else where the application there is so sacrosanct that we have to maintain the principle even if it produces crazy results?
Right. I mean, the answer to the question vis-a-vis legal studies of Gemara and hermeneutic principles and the struggle to fit hermeneutical principles into every case, or that every case should enlighten us about the application of those principles of law, is definitely a question mark within the circle of Gemara study. Even when I know it might look like I could thrust another principle of Kenyan, the matter of Kenyan in this case, of accepting the contract and actually taking possession of something, right? Kenyan is possession. And I might be able to have that legal discussion here that would break the notion of the facts of the case. If I'm really working on this principle of the more severe versus the lesser, and he's not having to compensate anybody for any death if the homeowner kills him, either rightfully or wrongfully, could very well be that we're dealing with the issue of meeting. Now, whether it's so sacrosanct in other places that causes me here to be exactly on target with adjudicating this according to these principles, it's an interesting take. We'd have to look at where that principle shows itself in each of the spots and ask ourselves some question as to the challenges presented in those places.
Well, because I think in this room, everybody will be scratching their heads to say, it makes a lot of sense that if the person, if he's come in and he's committing a robbery and he's probably got really bad intent and he steals something or breaks it, that even if he goes free just because he might have been subject, you know, he doesn't have to pay it back and he can keep it and his children can keep it because it really was his.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's nuts. And I don't think these people at this time of the world in the 10th, 10th, 11th, 12th century or even whenever the Torah language appeared, that they were so different from us in terms of thinking about that rule. And does that make common sense?
And possession. And notions of possession.
It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So,
maybe if he or she is willing to, or if he is willing to risk his life to get within the house, the assumption is it's for a good reason, a legitimate reason he's saying, or perhaps that he's being forced to do it by someone else who's responsible, who has some, that for someone to risk his life to steal at night, that the motive must be not worthy of such punishment.
Sympathetic or not, let's move to just the last comment before we continue on the next time. And there is a way of relating to what you're bringing forward right now in this sense. This is where I want to ultimately stop and end up with yet another question. So, you might be familiar with the moral philosopher Lawrence Kohlberg. The famous scenario is as follows, regarding one's willingness to steal. I can just steal because I'm inclined that way. And when I ask a child who's this many years old, because Kohlberg's work is about the development of moral sense and morality in children, and then went on to ask the same in adults, and whether or not adulthood is a time that we assume someone's morals are fully in place, and whether in their 20s, post-Kohlberg, Robert Cole's work with moral development, is all about whether or not people are still developing their moral centers and compasses, and at what ages that stops, and if it ever stops. Long story short, so if I ask young children, is it wrong or right that this person stole from a pharmacy? And they say, it's wrong. And they say, is it wrong or right the person stole from a pharmacy the drugs that he or she needed for someone sick at home? And at a certain point, at a certain age, the child will move from, it's totally wrong to steal, to, oh, the case is a little bit more complicated. And then at a certain point, beyond that, the next stage of that is the relationship to the questions of society and how they are the gatekeepers and guardians of the availability of whatever's there that will provide the healing. And the complicated nature of the moral reaction, the moral understanding that we have, then leads us to the ethics of the situation and the difference between right morals, the values of it all, and the way that it's acted upon is the ethics. Inherently, the question is that ever present really within this case in Torah? That it arose just here is, I think, worth examining. Whether or not the rabbis intended us to see it in that light, again, is a question perhaps maybe indicated by the fact that it was talking about some type of movable property, some even livestock, and then it had to come in the midst of that, and we have to deal with the reality that things are worth money, and thieves do their stealing, and what really are their intentions? Again, back to the intentionality. Can we truly say that they would kill, absolutely kill, and therefore they have this death penalty or not? So every stage of our starting and stopping within the next several parts of the sugyot will get us there. Let's see if the case becomes more complicated. Let's see if it stays on course to deal with the legal principle. I believe we have the business of counting the Omer. So we'll rise. I brought my Omer count this time. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kidishanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer Hayom Shlosha V'esrim Yom Shehem Shlosha Shavuot U'shne Yamim LaOmer. Everybody can say the blessing. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kidishanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer. You can repeat Hayom Shlosha V'esrim Yom Shehem Shlosha Shavuot Ushne Yamim LaOmer. It's the 23rd day of Yomer. 3 weeks and 2 days. This is a counter. You can pair these off, but since I use it each year. It's a magnet. Many a household can just put these right up on the refrigerator, or old refrigerators anyway that were made out of metal. And you have different prayers. This is the option, right?
But this is one summer. Generally, the spirit just didn't get there.